From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new partnership between Northwestern Mutual, UWM, and Marquette aims to put Milwaukee on the data science map.
Data science is an all-encompassing term. It says nothing about the volume of data or the type of data. Data science is equally valid, whether it be on massive amounts of data or small amounts of data. Everything is data science.
Later, when we talk about making cities bike or pedestrian friendly, are some people being left behind?
If we think about, a grandma maybe with a child walking around and biking around, what do they need to be able to walk and bike? And if we design it for that 8 to 80 age range, everyone will enjoy it.
Plus, we'll meet one woman who likes nothing more than racing her bike on Wisconsin roads.
And film contributor Dave Lurson says 2018 is the perfect moment in history for a documentary about Mr. Rogers. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Whether you realize it or not, you are creating digital data everywhere. When you log onto a website, post a photo on Instagram, or tweet a thought. As a result, understanding data has become central to understanding the interests of business and society.
Milwaukee-based Northwestern Mutual announced a new multi-million-dollar partnership today with Marquette University and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The three institutions will create the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute.
The aim is for the collaboration to help Milwaukee become a national hub for technology, research, and business. Professor Cheyenne Guhart, director of Marquette's Data Science Program, and Purush Papatla, Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at Sheldon Lubar School of Business at UWM, sat down with WUWM's Mayon Silver to discuss the opening. Papatla explained the significance of data science.
Data science is essentially taking large amounts of historical data on anything and using that data to understand what is going on as a means of predicting what might happen and also of understanding what to do in order to optimize or maximize the outcomes. So to talk about specific examples, let's say in the context of business, we all know that social media is very popular today. So just if you take Instagram, on any given day, on the average, about 90 million photos are posted. On Twitter, about 500 million tweets go out. So when all of this is happening, people are essentially sharing their thoughts on things. So if there is a way for businesses to understand what people are thinking about, what their preferences are, what their needs are, by mining through this data, they can come out with better products and reach the right customers, thereby improving consumer welfare and reducing their costs. So that's what data science does.
What, Cheyenne Guha, is the difference between data science and big data?
I think of data science, the term data science, essentially as an industry term given to research that is done within organizations. A lot of the entities and organizations that currently do data science within a particular industry, they have rebranded what they used to call their business analytics divisions or advanced analytics divisions or research and development divisions. So in a sense, it is reorienting and rethinking how data can be used to answer strategic research questions. Now, about the difference between data science and big data, data science is an all-encompassing term. It says nothing about the volume of data or the type of data. Data science is equally valid, whether it be on massive amounts of data or small amounts of data. Everything is data science. Big data is generally a term that is often thrown around, definitely a buzzword. But academically, big data is often thought of as data that kind of covers a certain volume and a certain density of data. I think the term science is important here because you want to approach answering strategic questions that an organization cares about using the scientific method. You want to think about it from a structured perspective.
So given the fact that data science is in fact a science and is a way of looking at this in a scientific method, what are some of the problems that this initiative would start to tackle in looking at data science?
In my own lab, for instance, we are looking at issues of fairness, accountability, and transparency in algorithms. Data algorithms and their outcomes can be used in many good ways, but can also be used in many bad ways and can reinforce existing structural inequalities that exist across our society. So this is something of great interest to Marquette, something that we deeply care about, something that personally my lab has been working on for quite some time. But we are also focusing on other outcomes that in many of the research groups' cases relates to doing data science for social good. So, for instance, we have labs that are looking at trying to use low-power, low-cost phones, not even smartphones, but low-cost flip phones, if you will, in developing regions to understand, measure things like depression or stress. Phones are nothing but a collection of sensors. They're collecting data about us all the time. So is there some way in which we can use the data that we ourselves generate by carrying around a phone in our pockets? So there are groups that are dealing with that. There are groups that are trying to look at, you know, in many cases, blood tests are expensive, especially if you don't have insurance or can't pay out of pocket. But is there some way in which we can use a smartphone camera to do blood tests? And if we can do blood tests, can they accurately measure, say, glucose level? Maybe I am diabetic and I want to measure my blood sugar, but I can't afford detailed blood tests. Specific to Northwestern Mutual, NM as an insurance company obviously has regulatory issues around the types of data science that they do. And therefore, a lot of people at Northwestern Mutual are deeply interested in some of these issues. For instance, the insurance industry practices price discrimination. Price discrimination as a concept is not necessarily a bad thing, but can it be equitable? Can it be ethical? These are questions that every insurance company thinks about, and that's something that we look forward to working with NM.
In the frame of the whole Facebook scandal with Cambridge Analytica, we're talking about the ethics of using data and getting people's permission to use it. How does that factor into things going forward in this type of program?
That's a good question. I think in addition to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, or perhaps because of that, there are a number of questions being raised both from a regulatory perspective and consumer perspective about how technology companies and social media in particular are using data, right? So I think that's going to have major implications for data science, big data, and the use of big data. And I just want to go back to your question earlier about what big data is. I have a slightly different take. Big data is a term that has evolved to refer to data that's not numerical. So data has always been thought of as numbers, digits. Big data refers to any source of information that's not number-based. So pictures, videos, audio, text, consumer reviews, for example, all of these are what big data is. So going back to your question about what this Cambridge Analytica scandal would mean, so yesterday the Wall Street Journal had a special issue on exactly this question. What does this mean for how businesses and firms in general can use this massive amounts of data that's being generated every day? So as an example of what that would do to businesses and how the data science initiative between the three of us can help, all of us have experienced when this where we go to a website, we look at for a product, we leave the website, we go to a different website, and an ad for the product shows up. That's based on the information that's being collected about you. So going forward, given these scandals, that kind of a practice might not be possible anymore. So companies need to look for other ways of using data without violating people's privacy, but still in a way that would help the business, right? So those are the kind of initiatives that this institute can help in. How can we use big data in a way that would help solve problems both for businesses and in general in society, but in a way that does not violate privacy, that's ethical and that's legal? So that's where we can really help.
And are there really any privacy? Is there really any privacy anymore?
Not really. But I think what Professor Babatla said was absolutely right, that I hypothesize that we will, in, you know, very soon we are going to see some regulatory action around some of these issues, which are going to make data collection and analyses much more complicated. This is a complicated world. There are no, you know, simple answers really. So hopefully some regulatory action will make things better.
So is Northwestern Mutual, since they're part of this initiative, are they going to have interests in the type of academic teaching that's being done? Are they going to have intellectual property rights for anything? How are they involved in this? And does it always have to factor in their interests?
In a certain sense, that's true, especially if we are going to do joint collaborative research with Northwestern Mutual. And it's not just Northwestern Mutual that has to care about IP issues, but it's also Marquette and UWM. But I actually see this as a very good opportunity to really liberalize some of these institutional collaborations. Because I think that with what this initiative can really do is foster better tri-institutional collaborations and reducing the barriers to collaboration by figuring out IP sharing agreements and other issues, I think are going to be a huge part of this. As far as specific numbers go, I think this is going to be almost a $35 to $40 million investment by all three institutions. And Northwestern Mutual has also committed to provide an actual physical space for this initiative in their technology center downtown, where representatives from all three institutions can sit together and actually work. I'd also like to point out that these types of data science initiatives, this is very novel for the Midwest, but these types of initiatives already exist in other places across the country.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for coming on and speaking about this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Professor Shayan Guha is director of Marquette University's Data Science Program, and Purush Papatla is associate dean of academic affairs at UWM's Lubar School of Business. They spoke with Mayan Silver, and you can read more about the school's new data science partnership with Northwestern Mutual at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then explore whether the way urban planning is done today discourages women from becoming more avid cyclists. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. A couple of weeks ago, leaders in the movement to build bicycle trail networks around the country met in Milwaukee to talk about the effort and share what they've learned. The planned route of the Badger in this area would eventually encompass some 500 miles of trails. While cyclists already use several hundred miles of bicycle trails in the region, many do most of their riding on roads, both with and without dedicated bike lanes.
But an article recently in the UK's Guardian newspaper made the point that much of the existing bicycle infrastructure, save for the bike trails, in many countries was built with only the hardiest of riders in mind. And that leaves many people, especially women and children, with few viable options. We wondered if that was a familiar refrain in this area, and so Lake Effect's Susan Bent sat down near the Oak Leaf Trail with Wisconsin Bike Federation Deputy Director Jessica Weinberg and asked her.
The article was really interesting. I do think we're in a new era of bicycle facilities design. The first things we were able to do were for the strong and fearless bicyclists, so that was really a stripe of paint on a roadway and having that be the physical space that you get to ride in. And it helped. It taught drivers bicycles are legal vehicles, they should be on the road, and we have seen big increases in biking across the country and in Milwaukee. So that worked for the strong and fearless cyclists, which I am one. But if we want to get a much bigger slice of the population biking, then we need more advanced facilities with actual physical separation between.
This writer was talking about, you know, is in Great Britain, for one, in the United
right.
Kingdom. One of the issues that she is citing in Manchester, I think in particular, is that city planners tend to be male, that the people on councils tend to be male, and they're determining budgets and where to allocate those monies. How does that compare to here?
Yeah, that concept was really interesting. You know, do we have these facilities because men are planning them? So, of course, men are more comfortable with them. I'm still thinking about that and if that's part of what we're dealing with here. Yes, at traffic engineering, traffic design is a male-dominated field. I think it's less and less so all the time. So that might be happening. And the Milwaukee Common Council didn't have a single woman on it for, I think, 5 years. So, you know, we do have these issues with men making more of the decisions. I'd like to think men can make good decisions for all of us. There's actually a cool movement, too, to really try to think about children in city planning. And they're for sure left out of the official process. There are no children in common councils or designing anything. And it's really interesting to think about how inhospitable our cities are to children. And so that's like another proxy you can think about, and that definitely when people aren't involved in the process, their needs aren't going to get met.
What's your sense of female writers versus male in your world, in this world?
Yeah, in 2009, women did account for 24% of bicycle trips in the U.S. That's the latest data we have that's gender specific. You know, I think that's an imbalance that we want to change and improve, and we can. And I think if you look at trails or other separated bikeway facilities, the ridership would be more balanced. But when you look overall, there is that skew. And we see it again and again in talking to people or in surveys that women want more safe spaces to ride. And we do have a reckless driving problem in Milwaukee. Walking and biking are safe, but it doesn't always feel like it is, and it could be safer. Women also do the bulk of trips, taking their kids to and from school or daycare. And I know as soon as I had my son, I felt that my own life was a little bit more important and I wasn't willing to take risks, knowing I was responsible for him. And then, of course, when he was with me on the bike, I did want a comfortable experience, not being nervous that anything was going to happen. So I think if we can, we have space in Milwaukee, we have very wide streets, we have wide right-of-ways, we have abandoned railroad corridors, we can make more separated facilities, and I think that is our next push, and it'll have such big public health benefits, economic benefits. Everyone wants these facilities. One of the best ways to think about urban design in general, not just for biking, is that you want to design for the least able or the, you know, the most disadvantaged. And if we think about, you know, I don't know, a grandma maybe with a child walking around and biking around, what do they need to be able to walk and bike? And if we design it for that 8 to 80 age range, everyone will enjoy it.
Something that I hear anecdotally, and I ride my bike when I can, I commute when I can, I've heard from a number of vehicle drivers who intensely dislike bikers in general. Am I overstating?
No, I mean, I think there are still some drivers who don't like people biking, which I really don't understand, because everyone who's biking is giving more space to those who continue to drive. They're making traffic better for people who drive. Yeah, I don't know where there's still this, you know, get out of my way kind of feeling sometimes. I do think it's way better in Milwaukee over the last.
No, you're saying get out of my way on both sides, both on the biker side and the vehicle driver's side?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's the people who are driving cars who are much more like, get out of my way, because as a bicyclist, you can't force anything. I've been thinking about this recently, that cars are basically bullies, whether people intend that to be or not. So I think a lot of drivers actually are bullies when they drive, even if they don't really realize it. You can see people at a crosswalk that's marked. It might even have a sign saying yield to pedestrians in the crosswalk. I saw this on Brady Street yesterday. And unless the pedestrian is completely forcing their way into the crosswalk, most drivers don't want to stop. And I think the drivers are kind of like, oh, you don't really need me to stop. You're going to be okay with this. And they're just bullying their way to getting more space.
You know, I feel like that's a complicated issue because I see cyclists as well who aren't following the rules
right.
of the road.
Right. No, there are There's been some studies that really show that humans break traffic laws at the same rate across modes. The issue is when you break a law in a car, it's a 4,000-pound vehicle that can kill people easily. When you break a law and you're walking or biking, you will only hurt yourself. And I think as a society, we have to say that that is very, very different. When a drunk driver drives, we're so concerned because they're endangering everyone around them. We have to say that innocent people deserve to be protected and that you have a responsibility when your actions could hurt other people, and it's your job to keep everyone around you safe. And that's really the traffic change that we need to see, is that we all take a responsibility for everybody around us and think about their safety. And, you know, for the drivers that we were talking about before, people who drive who don't like bicyclists on the roadways, they should be the biggest supporters of separated bikeways. If you give bicyclists great paths, great protected bikeways, make it very clear who should be where, then the person driving won't have to share their lane as much with someone biking.
So again, back to this Guardian opinion piece, the number one reason for not biking, for commuting, they think of it as being dangerous. They feel more vulnerable, reluctant to own the lane. Now, you said you're a fearless rider. Is that what you see as part of the complexity of this? Maybe it's not a women thing, that some bikers are not owning the lane?
Yeah, I think it's very true that the more knowledgeable and confident you are about the laws and how you should safely be operating as a bicyclist, the safer you make yourself. And part of that is being comfortable taking the lane. That's one of the things we really focused on our Savvy City Cycling classes. This spring, we taught a few classes specifically to a women's audience, to some women's bike clubs in the area, because there's something nice about having a group of women come together and talk about what are the issues on the street, and we can talk about catcalling, and does that really happen? Should you be nervous about it, or is it not a big deal? But one of the big things we teach in our classes, whether it's a female audience or a mixed group, is that you should take the lane when you need to, and you have that right. And when there isn't space to share, you can take the lane. And doing that does make you safe. It makes sure that people passing you go into another lane. And it's hard to know that you can do that unless you either know the law or have ridden for a really long time, or you take one of our classes. So if you take a Savvy City Cycling class, you can learn those details. And I hear again and again from people who take our classes that by learning that they can take the lane and they don't have to hug the curb, they do feel safer and more comfortable, and cars actually give them more space. So there is a confidence thing that helps the drivers around you treat you better, and that crosses genders. It's really for everybody. One thing that's kind of relevant to this is that the Path to Platinum group with Professor Schneider at UWM did a survey really asking people about their preferences for biking and what are the issues and why aren't they biking, and he did a gender analysis. So he found that although both men and women thought that unsafe intersections, bad drivers, automobile traffic were big issues that were barriers to biking for them and for other people, women identified these in much greater numbers. So, you know, those are major, major concerns for women. And personal safety was slightly higher for women as well. But more than 60% of women said unsafe intersections, bad drivers, and automobile traffic were concerns. And men were more around the 50% range. So, you know, it's not a huge difference, but it's something. And it really ties in well with where the city of Milwaukee and the communities around want to go with biking, that they want to put in more trails, they want to put in more separated bikeways.
Does this piece, back to The Guardian, does it give you some food for thought in particular?
The Guardian piece definitely gives me food for thought, especially about thinking about who's not at the table when planning decisions are getting made. In this instance, there's a focus on gender, but there's lots of other things that matter. Is it children? Is it race? Is it immigration status? You know, and how do we know what these other people's needs are? So the Bike Fed's been working with the city of Milwaukee on a complete streets policy, and we've been working with 5 community groups that do in-depth outreach and have deep connections with these various communities, and we're working to help connect their voices and their concerns to this policy that's really setting up how are we gonna make our streets look in the future. And safety is gonna be at the center, and it turns out that immigrants on the near south side and longtime residents on the northwest side both want their streets safer. They want slower speeds, and they want the ability to walk and bike for them and their families. And the city's been really responsive and wants to hear more of that feedback. And they admit that when they just have a meeting and say, hey, who wants to come and talk about, you know, this 35th Street getting reconstructed? It might only be certain people that show up, and they're very open to thinking about new designs that bring a wider perspective.
Jessica Weinberg is deputy director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation. She spoke with Lake Effect Susan Bentz. You'll find a link to the Guardian article that spurred their conversation at WUWM.com.
One woman who has not been shy about spending time on her bike on Wisconsin roads and tracks is Lindsay Kreet. We'll talk with the elite level cyclist when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Beginning this afternoon in Kenosha, hundreds of professional, elite, amateur, and lower-level cyclists will compete in the 11-day Tour of America's Dairyland. The series of criterium races plays out in various cities in southeastern Wisconsin, and it will feature men, women, and many different types of bike racing.
One woman who is eagerly awaiting several of the stages is elite-level cyclist Lindsay Kreet, who rides for Team Benelux when she is not doing her full-time job in Wauwatosa. Kreet has tried and competed in many forms of cycling, from road to track to cyclocross and mountain biking. She explained to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski what drew her to the sport.
Like many adult cyclists, they fell into the sport by way of a running injury or triathlon gone wrong, which is what happened to me in both instances. So I historically am a runner, and I had a foot injury that prevented me from running for a period of time. So I switched over to biking and decided to dabble with racing and discovered that I really, really enjoyed not only biking in and of itself, but even more so the community and the people that I have met through cycling have been amazing. So I've kind of stuck with the sport and never gone back to running as a primary focus ever since that injury.
Well, and even though you have a history of different sports, I understand you also do skiing in the wintertime and you dabble in also just different kinds of biking, whether it's road racing, velodrome racing, cyclocross. So with all these various activities, what does each one feed you with personally, like switching these formats within the biking community?
Well, I need to mix things up. I am not a creature of habit, so I like to kind of keep variety in my life. And a lot of cyclists spend their winter in their basements or in gyms on trainers. And that is a form of insanity for me. So I ski in the wintertime. My first passion is alpine skiing, but living in Wisconsin, I can't do that because we don't have mountains here. So when I moved back to Wisconsin from being out both east and west, I decided to pick up Nordic skiing as my winter sport, just for an avenue to get outside on two sticks under my feet, and discovered that I really love Nordic skiing. So in the wintertime, instead of spending time on a trainer, I spend time on trails in the snow and have developed a huge passion for that. So I do love winter. But then transitioning into spring and summer and fall, there's so many forms of cycling.
So with races like the Tour of America's Dairyland coming up, you know, how do you decide what your racing season looks like, what your biking season overall looks like between your interests and what you want to utilize most?
I'm probably different than the average cyclist or athlete where I continue to mix it up. So I am doing this track cycling once a week. I do enjoy road racing, not as much criterium racing, but Tour of America's Dairyland is such a staple in our community now that it's you can't not do it.
Right.
So I choose some crit races to do every year, including Tour of America's Dairyland and road racing and mountain bike racing. And then, of course, in the fall, what's becoming very popular, or what has become very popular, is cyclocross. So how I choose what to do, boy, that's a good question. I don't have much rhyme or reason to it.
Just look, look at the calendar and,
yes,
say,
and say, oh,
I think
that looks neat. I'll give that a try.
Well, and do you think, as you mentioned, most people, it's expected to race the criterium races and to be consistently at all of those things throughout the season. But do you think that, mixing it up gives you your own personal advantage, despite people maybe being confused of you coming into this race, like doing well, placing, but then they don't see you for a long time after that, whereas you get your regulars that continuously are racing in specific circuits.
So I wish I could say it gave me an advantage. I don't think that's the case, but I like mixing it up so much that I don't care. It keeps it fresh and exciting for me. Mm-hmm. But I think that a coach would tell me and you to pick something, make
stick
a plan and stick with it. And I kind of throw that out the window.
Right. Well, and I imagine it does a world of good for you just personally and mentally to be able to mix it up. Do you think just that with how you are and you know how you operate, that if you, say, had to stick to strictly street racing and criteriums, that it just wouldn't be as satisfying for you?
For me, for sure. Yeah. It's all about the variety and the community and keeping it fun. So from a mental and emotional health standpoint, yeah, I like to mix it up. Yeah.
So what does a successful ride look like to you, whether it's a practice ride or you have official bib numbers on?
Whether or not I gave it my all? If I feel good about the work that I put out in either a charity ride or a race or a group event, it's really afterwards, did I put into it what I wanted to put into it and get out of it what I wanted to get out of it?
Training for all these different kinds of events, you need a significant amount of time to do that, to be at the level of an elite athlete. And I'm curious, how do you balance maintaining that training all the while living your daily life and working a full-time job?
I have a great career right now and an organization that really believes in this work-life balance culture. So while my position is a great position within the organization, it's a long-term care facility called Lutheran Home and Howard Place in Wauwatosa, I can walk away from work at the end of the day and go about my life and come back the next day. So I am very blessed to have a great quality of life. I haven't had that in the past, where I've worked too many hours and haven't been able to get out and kind of reset via physical exercise.
I'm curious, what has your experience been as a cyclist garnering more attention and more access for other female athletes to get into the sport?
I personally have pushed really hard to get women more involved in the sport. So I raced for a team named Hollander Benelux Cycling, and I am in charge of the women's team. And I have put in a good effort over the years to try to get women to join the team.
What do you find is like the main obstacles for women to take that next step and to make competitive cycling a part of their lives?
It's an intimidating sport. I mean, for women, you got to put on a pair of Lycra shorts and get out to the start line of a race. And in the sport of cycling, there's this concept of being dropped. And what that means is there's a group of cyclists all clumped together and taken advantage of drafting and aerodynamics. And if a person can't quite maintain that draft, they will fall off the back and lose that aerodynamic advantage. And they fall off the back and become solo in their cycling pretty quickly. It's intimidating and it's scary, and nobody wants to be that person that falls off the back and is all alone. And then there's the reality of crashing. There is a danger to cycling, and you can crash on
a bike. Even recreationally, yeah.
Even recreationally, and it hurts. Road rash does not feel good. So I think there's a lot of barriers to entry when it comes to bike racing. Now I have seen more and more and more people get involved in cycling as a hobby, which is awesome. But it has been so difficult to get women, and juniors is another one where we're really struggling just over that hump to, hey, go try a race. It's fun and it's exciting, and there's a lot of gratification in entering this race. So juniors is a big focus of ours too, and we're not finding a ton of youth who are interested in getting on the road. Now, Nika has come on the scene, which is awesome. It's the high school mountain biking organization, and they've done a fabulous job of getting youth involved in mountain biking. So the next step is trying to get these kids who are excited about mountain biking and Nika to transition over and give road cycling a try.
Outside of the dangers concept and the intimidation of operating at that level and racing, you know, do you think the public has a common misconception about competitive road cycling that perhaps doesn't make it as popular a sport to go and see as, say, like soccer or football or anything that's in our own backyards?
Yeah. So I have three brothers and a father who are pretty traditionalist. They're, you know, kind of good old boys who love the Packers and the Brewers and the Bucks. And they think I am odd because I cycle. They love me, but they have frequently said to me, "Man, Lindsay, what? Why do you do that?" So yes, yeah. It is certainly a non-traditional sport.
What's going through your mind when you're, quote, in the zone?
When I'm racing and there's people around me, I am constantly paying attention to where everybody is around me and where I ought to be. So that is not only from a competitive standpoint, but also a safety and risk standpoint too. So got to move around this person, got to get in front of this person, going to drop behind and move to the other side. So it's strategic and tactical from a competitive standpoint, but also a safety standpoint.
And how about on training rides when you're going solo?
What am I thinking about?
Yeah. Like,
oh,
what pushes you to, you know, you're spending a lot of time on the saddle, and some people use it as therapy to work out whatever. I'm curious with your level of dedication and how much time it takes to be, you know, at the level you're at in so many different areas of the sport. What is keeping you driven?
So many different things go through my head when I'm on a bike ride. It totally depends on the day. Sometimes I just like mash out my anger in the pedals, and that's all I can think about is just like getting rid of the anger that I have in me. And other times I'm thinking about work and preparing for the meeting that I have tomorrow. Other times I'm thinking about my family or my dog or going through my grocery list. But if I'm in the zone, I'm thinking about my breathing and my pedal strokes and just concentrating on pure cycling as a sport.
You mentioned Wisconsin has a lot of good advocacy and momentum in their favor for the biking community. In what other ways has living in the Milwaukee area or in Wisconsin in general shaped your biking career? You know, would you have more or less opportunities, say, if you live somewhere else with a different kind of biking community?
So Wisconsin is interesting in that depending on where you live regionally kind of dictates what your focus is. So southeastern Wisconsin has a pretty strong road focus. And I think that very much has to do with Tour of America's Dairyland coming on the scene 10 years ago. So they're celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year. And from year one to year 10, I have observed a major upswing on cycling in general, cyclists out on the road, and people talking about the sport and interested in the sport. So people know what Toad is. Most people I talk to have heard of the races, have gone to the races or expressed interest in going to them, which is super cool. And that's very much southeastern Wisconsin. Now, you go even further south to Kenosha, Racine area, they're talking about the Velodrome because we have the Velodrome down there. So there's a cluster of track cyclists down in that area. As you get farther north, there are more gravel roads. So you're going to meet a lot more gravel cyclists and mountain bikers. So it's really interesting because it's very much regionally driven.
Well, Lindsay Crete, I want to wish you the best of luck with upcoming races, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to let me pick your brain about cycling today.
Thanks, Audrey.
Lindsay Crete is a Milwaukee-area bicycle racer. She'll be one of the hundreds of athletes competing in the 11-day Tour of America's Dairyland that begins today through July 1st.
A new documentary about famed children's TV host Mr. Rogers opens in Milwaukee this week. We'll get a review from Lake Effect film critic Dave Lurson when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyson.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you grew up watching public television, that song might have taken you back to the land of make-believe and into the television home of Fred Rogers. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood first aired in 1968 and aired first-run shows for more than 30 years.
You might not expect that a program with a soft-spoken and gentle man in a zip-up cardigan playing with puppets would have touched so many people, but generations came to know Mr. Rogers as an essential part of their lives, early education, and just their childhood in general.
A new documentary by award-winning filmmaker Morgan Neville gives audiences an in-depth look at Fred Rogers. Won't You Be My Neighbor examines the life and legacy of the children's TV host in a flattering but complex way, and it features archival footage, interviews with family and friends, and explains how history influenced the series.
Dave Lurson is one of our regular film contributors, and he visited the studio to talk about his reflections on the film with Audrey Nowakowski.
Dave Lurson, welcome back to Like Effect.
Always good to be here, Audrey.
So how badly did the world need a documentary like Won't You Be My Neighbor right now?
I think it's extremely timely and sad, really. I left the screening of the film feeling kind of warm and sad, if that makes any sense.
It does.
The ideals of Mr. Rogers have certainly, you know, been much abused, and we live in a very different world than the one I think he imagined. I mean, you know, he wasn't talking about Mr. Rogers' gated community after all. I mean, his idea of a neighborhood, of turning America into a neighborhood, which he defined as a place of safety where, you know, there are differences of opinion and different kinds of people living in this sort of neighborhood, but everyone could find a way of getting along, and there was a sense of true community, of people helping each other out if there was a need, of resolving differences. We don't live there, I'm really sad to say, but I keep coming back to one of the final scenes of the movie. He was brought back from retirement right after 9/11 to speak to the children of America about that. He looked absolutely shattered, like he could not comprehend how the world had turned to that point.
Right, and people can say what they like about events that have transpired since, but that his presence is definitely deeply missed for that platform, both for children and adults, because I feel most people going to see this may go in for the nostalgia, but as you hinted to before, you're going to leave with something much more impactful.
Well, one thing that I never realized, and I have to say I learned a lot from this documentary, which I think is the purpose of a good documentary, is to teach people something in an engaging, entertaining way. And I think that the documentary does that. It's really brilliantly done by Morgan Neville, Oscar-winning documentarian. Never a dull moment in the Mr. Rogers documentary. But I did not know the, let's just say, subversive character of some of his work early on. You know, at a time when desegregation was being fought by white supremacists, there was footage of white supremacists dumping toxic chemicals into a swimming pool to prevent African Americans from swimming in it. Mr. Rogers, puts his feet into a little, you know, pool, foot tub, I guess, and invites Officer Clemens, the African American patrolman in the neighborhood, to, oh, it's a hot day, why don't you put your feet in the pool with me? I mean, what a statement.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to preach and make a sermon out of it. It was just showing an ideal way that people could live together.
Yeah, a good point that we wouldn't really think about right away upon watching his program was that he was kind of the first televangelist, because he was creating this new formula out of television that, you know, was still trying to find its bearings.
Well, he had very definite ideas about television, and particularly the impact that television would have on children, presumably the most impressionable audience for TV. He really, I think, hated, if you could say Mr. Rogers hated anything, but he strongly disliked most of what was being offered to children. He fought a losing rearguard action against superheroes, for example. He felt that they were, you know, showing violence and presenting dangerously unrealistic role models for young children who might act. I mean, there was actually a case where a young child jumped off of a building with a cape thinking that he could fly. Well, that doesn't work that way. So televangelist, that's a loaded word. I mean, Mr. Rogers was a Presbyterian minister, but the gospel that he preached was considerably different than the one that the people we think of as televangelists, you know, were going on about. Basically, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, fundamental idea that many fundamentalists totally ignore. That was the root of his thinking. But you never, I mean, I never knew he was a Presbyterian minister until I saw the movie. I mean, he didn't make a point of that, but he tried to, I think, live out his ideals and present them in the most accessible way he could think of.
Yeah, his pulpit of puppets and pulpit trolleys puppets. And a well, house and...
The emotional vulnerability that he showed was startling. I mean, sometimes he did this through his alter ego sock puppet, Daniel the Tiger, but sometimes it was just him. I mean, a very vulnerable-looking person, and I don't think that very many people, certainly nowadays, would want to put themselves in such a position of vulnerability in public.
Right. It was a flattering yet complex portrait of Fred Rogers, and I also enjoyed the animation that was interspersed in this with him shown as Daniel Tiger, and that, you know, it can confirm that, well, if Fred Rogers has self-doubt, has depression, questions his influence, you know, surely we're all okay to feel that way as well.
Well, that was one of his things, too, was that we all have problems that we have to contend with, and it's okay for, I think, necessary to realize what they are, and to find someone you can talk to about it. I mean, kind of talk therapy for children, if you will. The movie points out the backlash against Mr. Rogers, the accusation that one result of his program was to rear several generations of self-absorbed, narcissistic, whiny, petulant people who assume that they are special simply because they exist. And the movie does make it clear that that was not exactly what he was trying to get at. He was not, and I was kind of surprised, he was a Republican, you know, of a sort that doesn't seem to exist any longer. I mean, we have to remember that there were liberal and moderate Republicans, all shades of opinion in that party at the time that Mr. Rogers was coming up. He was against entitlements, but he was in favor of the very basic idea that every human being is worth something. Every human being, by nature of living, has value. And I suppose he would say that you know, beyond that point, you create your value by what you do.
Well, in his lessons, and, you know, there's the common phrase, mother knows best, and Fred Rogers believed that with the way television and media and the consumer market was going, was that, no, Fred Rogers knows best, because these children aren't getting what they need from what's out there at the moment. He was truly someone who would address the child as an individual through the screen. You know, that the controversy that, you know, we're entitled, but then again, now we have, oh, millennials are entitled. They expect everything to be done for them or something like that. So you have that of every generation, but for him to have each child as that special individual, but also the power of acknowledging the feelings you have, sharing them, and also the power of silence.
Well, silence, you know, yes, there's not enough of that in today's world, and there already was a diminishing amount of it in the media of Fred Rogers' time. He understood the importance of silence, which is the backdrop against which everything happens, for one thing. Silence enables us to think, and maybe one of the things he wanted to do, if you could map out the agenda of Fred Rogers, was he wanted people to think about themselves, think about themselves in relation to other people, think about the effect of what we do on other people and the world that we live in.
He basically created a format with perhaps the worst formula in an era where television was still learning how to walk on its own. You know, he did the writing for the show, composing the music, singing, production. You know, it was a low production value, unlikely star, and yet it turned into this success that aired for more than 30 years.
Yeah, how to account for that? He struck a chord, obviously, with millions of people. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, he intended the show for a preschool audience. I think that the audience was larger than that very soon. Did parents steer their children toward it? Did children discover this on their own while flipping the dial when TV sets had dials on it? Probably a little bit of both. To me, looking at him, he was already anachronistic looking in 1968 when he debuted. He looked like, to my mind, a kind of 1950s camp counselor or something, you know, 10 years too late. In this sort of 1950s sitcom living room, you know, sitting around talking, it seems unlikely, but somehow it worked, maybe because of the genuineness, the aura of integrity that surrounded his presentation.
Yeah, and the documentary really did settle a question. Yes, he really was like that, you know, on and off the camera.
Right. I mean, I guess it does indicate that he had his trying moments, though, once in a while, but... I'm happy to know it wasn't a fake pose all those years.
Exactly. The skill to consolidate all of this information yet highlight the key moments of both his success and his trying moments. Did you feel that there was a great balance of the archival footage of the show and also of him just interacting with people, but then deeper moments that weren't scripted and also just felt like there was good testimonial balance when typically documentaries can either lean too heavily on one source over another?
Well, I mean, Morgan Neville is very skilled. I've enjoyed some of his previous documentaries. This one will probably, I mean, I think it's certainly Academy Award nomination worthy and may very well win. It's too early to make these kinds of predictions now, but I think because of the widespread interest in the subject, for one thing. But yeah, the animation makes it entertaining and illustrates certain aspects of Fred Rogers' life and ideas. The archival footage, of course, was absolutely necessary given the subject matter. And yes, well-chosen interviews with surviving family and associates. Nice to meet his real children, I mean, to see how they turned out. That's interesting. One of his crew members for the TV show made the kind of, again, a sad, melancholy comment that, you know, nice guys like him aren't as common as they once were. And I think that's very true.
Do you feel that this is kind of a reminder of what we're lacking in TV and media nowadays, too? I mean, not just with children's programming, but that impact overall when there's so many shows per channel, per hour, you know?
Well,
platform.
I suppose no one program nowadays for children or for any other particular demographic could have the widespread influence of a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood because of the splintered, fractured nature of the media and our attention spans being dragged one way and pulled the other constantly by the hundreds of different options out there. This was still the era of three commercial networks and PBS. So choices were limited and a show that caught on could really catch on in a bigger way, I think, than anything possibly could now. But I think that what we might be lacking right now is television with the kind of humane values that Fred Rogers tried to put across.
Well, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and the writer of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski about the new documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is opening on Milwaukee screens this Friday.
You know, it's such a good feeling to know you've been listening to today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next.